Welcome to The Creative Shift. My name is Dan Blank, author of the book Be the Gateway and founder of WeGrowMedia.com. Today I have an amazing interview with author Gigi Pandian. She's a USA Today bestselling author and an Agatha Award-winning mystery novelist with 10 books. So we cover a lot in this interview, and there's so many critical points of wisdom that she shares. She was pursuing her PhD when she decided to stop and move to Berkeley and enroll in art school and start seriously working on a novel. And like most writers, she had dabbled with this for years. And she talks about how when she finally decided to do this, that this is when she knew it was the right thing for her, that when she was following her passion, everything fell into place in her life. And she makes the point that this was not just following the path of least resistance, that this was the more difficult path, but that it's the one that filled her with more fulfillment. And she goes on to talk about really her path to success, where she started that book with NaNoWriMo in the early days, and she got some early validation, which was phenomenal. It's what we all dream of. But then she talks about how it took years to get that book published, that she got an agent, but publishers kept rejecting it, you know, or not accepting it. And she eventually went with Plan B. She self-published it. And because she was so involved in the community of other mystery readers and mystery writers, it found an audience, so much so that a publisher picked up that book and the whole series. And then she then sold a second series. And she really talked about how critical it was to be involved in the community of readers, how that not only has led to her book's success, but again, also led to this process being meaningful to her as a writer. And she also discussed this whole idea that I think is something that many or most writers struggle with. We all dream of this idea of writing full time, quitting our job, not having the responsibilities we do so we can write all day. She talks about how she really took a sabbatical from her job in order to do that and found that she wasn't writing any more than she was when she had to work her job. And that when you have your whole day free to write, that it can sometimes be more difficult than if you're working a part-time or full-time job. And she talks about why that is and how she navigated that. This is an incredible and inspiring interview filled with, I think, lots of very practical advice as well. If you like this episode or any others, please go and leave a rating over on Apple Podcasts. All right, here is Gigi Pandian. Hey everyone, this is Dan Blank. I'm very excited to be chatting with Gigi Pandian. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, Dan.
Okay, so I'm really excited to chat, and I kind of want to start at the beginning, if you're okay with it. And it's so fun doing research for these podcasts because you notice all the little things, and you have this great line in your bio. I'm the child of cultural anthropologists, parents, and then you've dragged all over the world. And in your Instagram, you have all these adorable photos of your parents. And it's the kind of thing that I love about social media is that it's sort of this place to kind of get to know someone. And as just someone who watches, like you, like these all become characters that I'm following. And I think it's kind of neat. But I guess I want to start from the beginning in terms of where did writing begin for you in life?
Yeah, and I think that so much of why so much of what I post on social media does still bring in my family from all of those childhood days is because those experiences really were what inspired me to write. I grew up an only child, and since I did get the opportunity to travel with my parents all over the place. My dad is from South India and my mom is American, and they were both doing research trips in India and Europe and all sorts of teaching gigs across the United States. So I just tagged along on all of those things, and it made me very independent from a young age in terms of being able to, if I didn't want to be bored, I had to go out and explore and meet other kids and, you know, and have adventures wherever I was. And so I started making up stories wherever I was to entertain myself, because sometimes there would be other kids to play with and sometimes there wouldn't be. And my parents were great and fun to hang out with, but they were also adults and doing boring adult things. And so I would also have to make fun on my own. So if we were somewhere, one example that I remember a lot, was that when my mom was looking for a certain, she was looking for someone in a graveyard. She was looking for one of the grave markers from someone who she was doing research on from another century. And we needed to find this before we could go inside out of the cold, blustery day and go get some warm food and, you know, hot chocolate or whatever I was having at that young age. And so I made a game of it that I would be the one to find that first. And so because I was the one that was eager to, you know, get out of that cold day. But so I ran around and this whole cemetery and this really mysterious place. And I was the one who found it. I do remember that, that she was the one who supposedly had the list of where we should go to find it. But I was the one who was just running around and could go find that. So just things like that, that just really, since I'm a mystery novelist, it was experiences like that. I always was drawn to the mysterious places and creating adventures out of places that I got to go.
So what, I don't know a lot about cultural anthropology, like what kinds of places would it bring you other than that cemetery? Or what kinds of topics I'm assuming that, as you're saying, like that this would give you all these ingredients that you would use later in life in little ways and stories, whether it's something big or something tiny.
Yeah. So it's a very broad field, and it's related to forensic anthropology and archaeology, but also a different branch that it looks more at ethnographies of different populations. And so my mom had done a lot of field work with Scottish crofters in the Highlands of Scotland. So people who lived off the land but didn't own the land, and the certain way of working on the land there and the communities that were built up there, and people who still spoke Gaelic there. And so that was where she did lots of field work when she was a graduate student. And when she was, I don't even remember if she was updating a second edition of the same book when I was little and got to go on that trip with her. But she was going back and reconnecting with many of the people that she had known when she was a graduate student, that this was then more than 10 years later that she was going back there. And so lots of different populations that might be things that are often overlooked. And then my father specialized in, before retiring, on comparative religion. So it's a very broad field that you can look at things in lots of different ways. And so that's why they also did different teaching assignments in different places in the States. And so when I think about traveling all over the world, that also means lots of places in the United States, in addition to abroad.
It's funny. I had no experience like that, but we had in the 80s when I was growing up a baseball card business. So in the weekends we'd go to these shows, and all in the tri-state area. I'm in New Jersey. But that way that you described, if we'd go somewhere and we'd be there for a couple of days, my parents are kind of working. I remember in all these like hotels where they'd have it, just as you said, that whole idea of trying to find kids or trying to find a cool nook or place, or is there an arcade, or, you know, this is back in the 80s, so you had all these legendary players coming to sign. So you'd get to like meet them or see them, that sort of thing. And it's,
yeah,
It's kind of neat to think about how that would create a different kind of experience for a child. When you were in school, were you a writer? Like when fourth grade, or when did it become a thing that you were like, you started really thinking about it or doing something?
I think so. My memory of it is different than my mom's, because she has.
Is that always the case?
It is true. But so she has proof though. So I know she's right, but I don't remember this one. It was in third or fourth grade. Apparently I wrote my first novel, but she still has it. But I don't remember writing this novel. But so obviously it was like a little 20-page booklet that had a picture that I drew the cover and then wrote this little mystery. But I don't remember writing that. What I do remember was a mystery adventure comic strip that I did probably around sixth grade or middle school, junior high age, that was Minnesota Smith. Instead of Indiana Jones, it was the Adventures of the version of Indiana Jones. So it was Minnesota Smith, and I drew little comic book adventures for her. So they were the first, because I still write adventure mysteries today, that's what I remember, because that's when I found the thing that was really fun that I wanted to tell adventure mysteries.
Oh my gosh, I love that so much. Because once Minnesota went as a hit, it was like, oh, it's genius. What is it about mystery? Because a mystery, I feel like, I mean, I understand why we like, I'm just trying to think of you as a kid, like why we are drawn to watching them or reading about them. To write a mystery is, I don't know, to me, it sounds like impossibly difficult.
Since I grew up in a house full of books, there were many different genres, and I was always drawn to the mystery. So it was the kids' books, of course. So I had written versions of Scooby-Doo Adventures in addition to the TV show and all the Encyclopedia Brown. Yeah, I was really into Scooby-Doo. And all the Encyclopedia. Did you read Encyclopedia Brown? I think you and I are right about the same age.
So. Yeah, I didn't read it. But for a minute, I was imagining like the 1800s source material for Scooby-Doo, like the literary versions that the cartoons are based on, which of course doesn't exist, but someone should write it.
Yes. Okay, see, I already have too many ideas, but now I have another one. So the mysteries were always the ones that I was drawn to, even though my mom tried to get me into science fiction and fantasy so much when I was little. She would just leave things out for me. She still does when I go home and visit, but it never stuck.
Wait, tell me a story of how she would leave things out for you, because I love that kind of, not passive aggressive in a negative way, but that kind of thing that people do. I'm going to leave this out in a specific way and I'll let them discover it.
Yes. And so it still is. Even now, like when my husband and I will go visit, there will be certain books that are left out for us just in case we would like some evening entertainment. So, but aww. Carefully curated books. So, yeah. But those were always the ones that I was drawn to. And so it was never a question of what I was going to write. I think it was more just that I was always a mystery storyteller. It's only been in recent years that I realized I was a writer as well. It's more the stories that I wanted to tell. And it took a long time for me to think of myself as a writer rather than these are stories that I just happen to be writing. Because when I was younger, I started also in high school, I was very involved in theater and I filmed many of my mystery stories. So they were never written things, but I would write a script, but then my friends and I would film them on our little Sony video handycam thing that we would edit.
What general years is that? What kind of time frame is that?
So that was the early 90s that I was in high school making those videos that we would have to edit with two VCRs and jog shuttle before all of this computer stuff.
Yeah, because my best friend, she is a professional photographer. And in our high school, we had an arts division, and they actually had a video program, and she was in it. So my high school experience, what you just said reminds me of my high school experience of watching her with the big camcorder all the time. Yep. And they actually had professional gear, which was kind of cool.
Nice.
But just, and then she would have all these little side projects I'd be involved with. But how, in a way, how empowering that was, because you could film and edit and create a story, which was like what Hollywood people did. And of course, how just how raw that footage and the quality was compared to what we're used to now, just on our phone even.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you have those kind of theater video friends?
Yeah. I was friends with the whole theater crowd. I had a good experience in high school because of that group, because it was a great group of creative folks who were filming. Lots of other people I knew were also filming their own stories. And
really,
I thought I was so cool because I would record these things, because these were mysteries and thrillers. So I would find explosion scenes and things from other TV shows that I would then splice into my thing. So I would have the whole setup, but I wasn't actually going to explode anything. So I would have 2 seconds of this explosion from the, you know, MacGyver or something, you know, that I would then splice into it. So we had a lot of fun doing things like that.
I love it. So then, after high school, what did you focus on? What was the, like, this is going to be my career kind of moment?
So I, for a long time, thought that I was going to follow in my parents' footsteps and become an academic. And because it was, they enjoyed it so much, and I had such a great life seeing that lifestyle, that you would work hard, but you would get to mentor these amazing students, and you would get to have summer breaks where you could travel and do research and go do all these things. So that seemed like the path that I was on. And I still hadn't considered that writing was something I didn't find myself a writer yet. I was still making up stories because it was fun, but I didn't finish anything. It was just a little thing that I would always be writing down, but not finishing or pursuing seriously. But then when I was in a PhD program, the first year into my PhD program, I realized this really is not for me. I've been doing this thing, but it was more just like the path of least resistance, because I could do it, that it seemed like that's what I knew. I was good enough at it, but I didn't have a passion for it. Mm. I couldn't see myself doing that for my entire life. So I ended up leaving the PhD program with only my master's. And I packed up everything I owned into my Volkswagen Golf and drove down from, that's not quite true. I couldn't fit my books. So I shipped my books to my parents' house, but everything else, I had inherited furniture from the law student who was living in my apartment before I had moved there. So I just sold for like $50 or something, the same furniture to the next student moving in after me. So I didn't have any furniture, sent my books home to my parents, everything else packed up in my Volkswagen Golf, drove from Seattle down to Berkeley. No plan, except I knew I needed to do something more creative in my life. So I moved in with a good friend in Berkeley. And that was the moment that I figured out, I have no idea what I'm doing. What do I want to do? So I got a part-time job. I started going to art school part-time, and I started seriously writing my first novel. And because I was finally following my passion, everything fell into place that summer. That was the summer I met my husband too. And just everything, the fact that I was open and doing something, not just the path of least resistance, but the difficult path, but the one I knew I needed to be on, that's what showed me I can do this. I really do need to be having a creative life.
So what is the build up to that decision-making moment? Because I can imagine if you grew up in seeing this profession that You're under no illusion. You're not someone saying, I want to be a lawyer because lawyer is whatever. And then you grow up and you're like, oh, lawyers are different. Like, you knew this profession from the inside. You went to college. You said, I'm going to get my PhD and my master's. You had to apply to a program. You had to get in. You had to move. You had to go through it. So, you know, this podcast is called The Creative Shift. And it's almost for moments like this, this idea of something is off and you want to make a change, and that the path to that moment is interesting, because I'm trying to imagine you've had at some point call your mom and say, hey, you know those loans I took out or whatever it was? What was the path to that like?
So I was very lucky that I was getting a PhD and not just a master's degree, because PhDs come with funding. So I did not have to be massively in debt to get there, because I was working as a teaching assistant one semester and a research assistant another semester. So I had, you know, tuition paid for and then a stipend to live on. So I was very lucky in that way that PhDs do fund you. I mean, it's not very much, but it's enough to live on. So I didn't have that aspect to worry about. But because it was always the thing that I thought I was going to do, I actually had to make the decision to drop out before I talked to either my parents or my college advisors, because I knew that they would all try to talk me out of it. But at some point, you have to not listen to the rational argument and just go with what you know is true in your gut. And I didn't make the decision right away. There was something I knew, I probably knew the first semester that it wasn't right, but I still gave it that year to make sure. But I didn't pursue it longer than necessary to know, because grad school is difficult. So it wasn't just a question of, oh, this is a difficult thing, so I don't want to do it. It was really, I had to give myself enough time so that I would know it wasn't just a reaction to this is being hard work. And as soon as I really had figured out this is not what I want to be doing, and I'm so, it definitely was the right decision, because my first mystery series does involve a professor. Like, that's my main character. She's a history professor. And I get to explore all of the aspects of academia I loved through my fiction, but I don't have to do the aspects that were crushing me. So, like, for my first book, I went and did research at, got a grant that let me go do research at the British Library in London to finish researching that book. And it, but it was the kind of research for fiction that I can find all these brilliant gems that are truly rooted in history. 90% of the history that's in all of my books is true. It's just the what if that diverges to make it fun fiction, as opposed to real life, that I adore reading nonfiction. There's so many brilliant nonfiction history books, but the ending isn't what I want them to be, because it's real life. And I want my fiction, you know, with the wonderful ending that we get when we're caught up in a story.
So you mentioned that you moved and you went to art school. What were you going to art school for?
I was doing graphic design and photography.
Mm.
I wish I was also an illustrator. It was one of those things that if there was more hours in the day, I would love to do that as well. But
that feels very 90s too. Graphic design was like the thing that was coming up. Photography, I remember still being, it was still pre-digital.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there was such an, it's funny, I don't know if people who are young can, like, it's, there was such an aura to photography back then. So I used to work in the city and just all the photo studios, all the bike messengers coming in with the film to get, and like, it was so otherworldly that this phone that we have, we all take photos, is like, it's a different thing what it was back then, that skill of photography.
And I still, in San Francisco, there is this amazing, the Harvey Milk darkroom, where you can go develop your own film and do all the things. And so it was only still for many years after digital took hold a group of three friends. So me and two friends would go there still on a regular basis to do real photography. And I still think of that as what the real photography is, but I don't do it anymore. But another one of those things, if there was more hours in the day, I love spending time in the darkroom. There really is something magical about that.
I love that. Okay, so then you said, of course, you started, like, I started writing my first novel. So this sounds like you were in the zone, you were open to all these things, and you made a choice to do that. So how did that get started?
The choice to do the novel?
Yeah.
It was because I had started so many things and never finished them while I was pursuing what I thought were the more important things in life. I wanted to actually finish something and I didn't know how to do it. And this was right at the time when National Novel Writing Month, NaNoWriMo, was first getting started by a group of friends in the Bay Area. So today, National Novel Writing Month, that challenge to write a 50,000 word draft of a novel in 1 month, in the month of November, is a huge thing that so many people participate in across the world. But at that time, it was this small thing, and I don't remember who mentioned it to me or how big it was then, but that, because this was the early 2000s, that I thought, I will sign up for this challenge publicly to actually just finish a novel. Like, I'd never finished anything. I've started so many stories, but when you first start writing, as you know, it takes a long time to get good. And it's so hard at first to feel like I can move on from this very bad writing to actually get to the end, that you keep wanting to revise what you're working on as you're doing it, when really it's so important to actually finish something and then you can go back and fix it. So National Novel Writing Month was really the trick for me that I needed to get myself over my inner editor, because I had committed that I wanted to finish something and didn't know how. National Novel Writing Month was how I was able to actually do it. And I was so excited when I finished a 50,000 word draft of the novel that I submitted it to the Malice Domestic Grant competition. And that's a grant that fosters the next generation of traditional mystery writers. So Agatha Christie style of mysteries, basically. So not thrillers, not gritty police procedurals, but puzzle plots, you know, that are not, you know, no on the page violence or anything, but that it's really about the mystery and the classic type of puzzle thing. So that's what I was writing. And so I submitted it just because I was so excited to have finished something, had no intention of, you know, ever hearing anything else again, but I ended up winning their grant that year. And that was the thing. I had already had my sense of accomplishment for finishing the novel, but I didn't know if I would do anything with it. But part of the grant is that they also pay for you to attend Malice Domestic, the mystery convention in Bethesda, Maryland. And so that showed me that it wasn't just something fun for me, but that somebody else saw something in my writing, saw some sort of potential. And as soon as I didn't know a single writer or anything at that time, but as soon as I set foot at that conference and was welcomed there, I knew that I had found my people and that this was a community that I wanted to be part of and that I didn't need to be part of it. I would have been part of it anyway as a reader because I'm first and foremost a mystery fan and mystery reader, but that also that they saw potential in my work in progress that I should learn how to make that good and see if I could do something with it as well. And there was no looking back from there.
I mean, that kind of early validation with the grant, it feels like the thing we all sort of hope, which is like, look, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to do the work for a little bit, okay? And after I do a little bit of work, I really want some kind of validation, one, to show me I'm on the right path, and two, to kind of give me a little push along, because you know what? I've just done a little bit of work here. Like, it's what we want for a lot of reasons. What was that like to get that? Because I feel like that's almost a rare thing, that idea of like, I'm finally... It's a weird thing, because you've clearly been writing at that point for so many years, but you haven't been finishing. So it's an interesting blend of being both very experienced and not experienced at all, right?
Yeah. And I think that I would actually, it was wonderful, but it also, when you get early success, it also is the double-edged sword that it also sets you up for failure more. Because right then I thought, this is amazing. They think I'm great. I'm going to sell this book quickly. And after that initial validation, it did take me many years afterwards to actually sell the book. And it was another couple years, first of all, to just finish making it good, from having a full manuscript with potential to making it good. And after that, then I did get an agent relatively quickly, but she was having a lot of trouble selling the book, because it's a traditional mystery, but it's also an adventure mystery. And so it doesn't exactly fit genre conventions. So I'm still with my same agent. She's incredible. And she kept trying to pitch it whenever there was a new opportunity, new editors, and all of these things. But she had been pitching it for a whole year when I was diagnosed with breast cancer right after my 36th birthday, which, not in the family, not expected. That came totally out of nowhere. While I was in the hospital getting that diagnosis, I missed a phone call from my agent telling me that she wanted to talk about a plan B, because she hadn't been able to sell that first book because we were hearing that it didn't fit. And I took that as fate, that I was getting this diagnosis, that I was going to have a year of cancer treatments ahead of me at the same time that she was like, you need a plan B. And I'm like, yes, I do. I need a plan B. So that's when I decided that I had the support of my agent, and we were hearing great things for editors, that they loved it. They just didn't know where it fit. So we thought that the book was ready and just wasn't, it was just a quirky book. So because I had that year of cancer treatments ahead of me, I decided that to celebrate finishing cancer treatments at the end of that year, I was going to have a big party, that I was going to self-publish my book and release it when I was done with cancer treatments, and have a cancer-free, I'm cancer-free party, assuming that I had survived the year, which I did, spoiler, survive that year. So the first iteration of that book was my self-published one, because of that push of getting the cancer diagnosis. But because I gave myself that time to learn how to do it right, the book ended up getting lots of good press and doing well. And that's when we got an offer from a publisher who wanted to pick it up and republish it and the whole series, thinking they could do even more for it. But once I had shown that there was a market for it, even if at first that was hard to see for publishers.
That's incredible to me. Just that story of, you're right, that early success where you got the grant and you're getting positive feedback. And then there's a couple years of making it better. And then you get the agent relatively quickly, which is amazing. But, and you're getting good feedback, but no one buys it. So you self-publish it, which is a huge pain in the butt. Like, it's such an effort to do that, and then you're making a certain track and all of that, and it does well. And it's like, it's just interesting to me, these sort of kickstarts where people come in, but it's like between those kickstarts is a lot of hard work and a lot of nothing happening in terms of like people just making it happen for you.
Yeah, no, publishing is definitely one of those hurry up and wait type of situations that you can work really hard and then hear nothing, and then all of a sudden things happen. It's a very strange business, but I love what I'm doing, so I put up with the very strangeness of it.
What was it about that first book that allowed it to just even get out there for people to read it and kind of get a readership?
I think a big part of it was the community. It was the fact that I was already, after that initial grant allowed me to attend that first mystery convention, I realized how important the community of readers was, so that I didn't want to be an author who was just out there with my head down in my book writing and not talking to other readers. And so I did start to, several years before I was published, I did start to attend more mystery conventions. So I did get to know how that whole world worked. I got to know independent booksellers who were there attending. I got to know avid mystery readers. And so I was able to get my advanced reader copies into the hands of people who could then write reviews. And I also did printed advanced review copies that I sent out for advanced reviews. So I did end up getting reviews. And this was, since this was 2012, before, like, so this was right at the start of when self-publishing things were starting to take off, but before, so it was very different then. But so I was able to submit for advanced reviews to places that now I'm not sure exactly what their policies are, because now I have publishers that take care of that. But I didn't keep it secret that it was a self-published book, but you wouldn't notice unless you looked for that, because it was professionally packaged. And because I'm a designer, I designed the cover, which was actually another thing that was both good and bad. It was a very good cover, but once I had a publisher, I realized that they knew the market better in terms of book covers, because I'm not a book cover designer. So I could make a great cover, but it wasn't necessarily as on target for to get me as broad a readership as I was then able to get.
So it's so interesting to hear that idea of being in the community. And this is something I think, you know, I work on a lot with people, but it's that idea where I can see a lot of writers saying, well, I don't want to go to these conferences because it's mostly other writers and writers don't buy books. Or, why am I going to be in front of readers? Because, you know, I'm not writing to them. You know, when I've got a book, then I'll talk to readers, because otherwise, what are we talking about? Like, that type, I don't know if you've experienced that in life, that kind of attitude of staying away until the book is ready.
Yeah, and I've tried to caution aspiring authors about that very thing, because I am very involved in Sisters in Crime and Mystery Writers of America, and in the Northern California chapters. And so when I go to events, and sometimes, well, there'll be a workshop and I'll meet a new writer who's just going for the workshop. But when I'll encourage them to come to some other things, and there is reluctance because people will often feel like, oh, I don't belong there yet. It's difficult to see, because I can understand why it is scary, because I don't know if I would have gone to Malice Domestic had it not been for the grant where they were going to present it to me there and they pay for you to attend. And since then I paid for it myself, but I don't know that as someone unpublished, not knowing anyone, that I would have known how wonderful that was, that it was so worth it, and that people, even before they're published, are welcomed, and how much there is to be gained by that community. So I always encourage people, whatever stage of writing you're at, figure out which ones. There's endless opportunities for which communities to get involved with, both online and in person, because even if you can't travel to events, there are great online mystery writer communities that I could have found. And I did also join online communities. So there are many different ways to find communities, even if you are not able to travel to the in-person ones, but just giving yourself permission to be part of the community even before you're published.
I always feel like some people have the challenge. I mean, everyone has the challenge of not feeling they have the time to devote the energy. And the other thing is also not knowing how to really be involved. And this is the weird double-edged sword of modern media, where it's so easy to join a Facebook group. Oh, I join the group. I check it every day. And yet it's so hard to really know how to take an action to forge a connection with someone. And it's actually just neat for me to think about, you were showing up at local chapters. It's the in-person thing, or I would have to imagine maybe the virtual things, but it's based in a local chapter. It kind of requires you to raise your hand a little bit and be seen.
Yeah. And there are, yeah, it's just, there are so many ways to get involved that sometimes I think you can do too many things as well, because it would be so easy if I am not very active on Facebook, because I have found other communities that I spend more time there, and I haven't wanted to just be superficially in places where I couldn't really be a part of the community there. So I frequently get invitations for all of these Facebook groups that look really fantastic. And I, for a second, I'm very tempted because I think these people look great and these discussions look amazing. But I know that I would only superficially be able to be involved, and I would rather have a few deep connections in some communities rather than 25 superficial ones. And I know it is a trade-off, and sometimes it is difficult to make that decision, and I do wonder about it, but overall I'm very happy with that decision. But it is, we have so many opportunities that it is challenging to say no to things.
So with that first deal, I believe you said they kind of signed a series. So you suddenly had, I mean, you had a career. I don't know if you'd consider it a career, how you would define that, but you had a career as a writer because publisher is expecting books from you.
Yes, which I love, because that's why it was, without National Novel Writing Month, I was not finishing things. And now with publisher deadlines, now I can really finish things. So I love deadlines.
What was that transition like to now saying, oh, now I have another book to do, and this is the due date, and of that sort of thing, where you're really embrace? Was that your main thing? Were you working another job at the time?
Yeah, so I I mentioned a few minutes ago that it's publishing is very much a hurry up and wait type of thing, that nothing happens for a long time and then everything starts to happen. So before I knew that that first series was going to get picked up by a publisher, I was working on a new project as well that I wrote a book proposal for. And my agent absolutely loved it. So she said, don't hold your breath, because it's really hard for a not established author to sell on proposal. But I love this, so let's see what we can do. Right within 3 months of signing that first contract to pick up my self-published series, she sold that second series on proposal. So all of a sudden, which was very exciting, and I loved that one too. That was something that I had thought of while going through chemo and written a draft of. And so it was just something I didn't think other people would like, but it was really coming from my heart and soul at the time. And so all of a sudden, even when we negotiated for more time from both publishers, all of a sudden I had to figure out how to write multiple books to a deadline. And that was very scary. So what I ended up doing was taking a sabbatical from my day job so that I could meet these deadlines. And it was the greatest experience, because it taught me many things. And the two of the most important things were, without any structure of a day job, it is, with your days wide open, it is very hard to get things done right away. Because if you think, oh, I can just do this other thing and then get to writing later on, then I wasn't actually much more productive than I was even when working a full-time job. But I also realized how much I missed my day job, because I work at a nonprofit that I feel very passionately about the work. And so I really miss that. And without structure, I didn't know how to focus my writing and my life. So the balance that I ended up doing was I went down a certain path at work that didn't have me taking promotions to be managing other people, and that allowed me to set my own flex time work schedule. And so, because I'm really lucky that doing as a designer, I have projects, but that I don't have to be, it's not like I need to be on call for things in the same 9-to-5 schedule that is often expected at a day job. And so now I really love that I know that if I have to be at work, well, now is during the pandemic, but, you know, still setting some sort of schedule, that if I need to start work at 12:30 in the afternoon, I will get more writing done that morning leading up to 12:30 than I would if I had the whole day free. And so it's a combination of just learning about my own tricks, like how I work best, but that also that I do love my job. And so it's not like I have anxiety about I have to show up here doing something I don't like to do. So I just switch gears, you know, and so I am able to have this part of my creative brain and then move over to the other part of my creative brain.
So how many books have you completed now? And I'm not sure if it's published or completed, what your schedule is.
So I have now have 10 books that have been published in 2 different mystery series. And I also write short fiction. So I've also published several short stories because that's another form that I love. And especially for mysteries and impossible crime locked room mysteries that I love, short stories are a really great medium for that.
How has your creative process evolved? Is it the type of thing where it's like you said, you started that early on and it's just honed, or have there been different phases of your life where it's like, well, then this other thing happened and I had to rethink the whole thing?
That is a really interesting question, because I think that's something that I haven't stepped back to think about explicitly. It's more just that I've learned to not know where this journey is going to go. And so that all of my choices need to be informed by what I would like to do. I am so lucky that I'm at a stage of my career where I have multiple choices about what I say yes to. So I am letting my gut lead me for which part of the winding path I should step onto next.
It's funny, you said something earlier that I actually think is huge. You know, you say you had this job and that you specifically didn't take the track that would really lead to promotions. You're going to manage people, you're going to do this, this, or that. I feel like that is such a huge insight, because this is where most people get in trouble. Because we all want to feel success. We all want to feel like there's progress. So we keep getting the promotion. And I've seen this in so many different areas where, you know, a person who likes tech goes in IT because they love working machines, they get promoted, and now they never work on the machines because they're managing people and they hate
it. Right, exactly. Yeah.
Or I remember my brother used to be a retail manager. He worked at Target. And I was talking to him over lunch one day. He's like, yeah, he's passing up this promotion. And it was a big promotion. I'm like, why would you do that? And like, because it's all this like growth and ambition. And he's like, you know, it's 8% more money, twice the amount of travel and twice the amount of responsibility. It's like, I'm not going to, you know, it's like, why would I choose that? And I feel like you had that in that decision, that choosing the bright early life was also putting boundaries on things.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I do frequently have people who will be saying, why aren't you going for that promotion that you would be great at and all these things? I'm like, nope, I don't want that. I really do not want to be checking work email when I am not working. And I don't, that mental energy and the hours that it would take, just all of it. I love what I do and I do it well when I'm there. And then I am free to also do writing when I am focused on that. And the balance has worked out really well. But yes, you're right that there is such an expectation that we should be moving up. And I feel like I'm still growing, but I'm just not moving up in the traditional way.
Yeah, it has me even, like, you know, I said the name of the podcast, A Creative Shift. I always think of it as that, like, you make a decision to take a risk. And I love the idea of framing that as the idea of just letting go of an opportunity to keep a stasis, which opens up time and energy, as you said, for the creative work. All right, we've covered a lot here. Is there anything that I haven't asked about that you think we should definitely cover around any of these themes?
I think that one last thing, we've already touched on it, but just not this specific aspect, that one other way to that I have a sense of community is in a more private space, is those one-on-one interactions with people that I get through my email newsletter. That I'm not especially active on social media. I enjoy it and I do post things and I do interact with a small core group of folks, but I've been growing my email newsletter for many years. And if people email me, I email them back. And I love my readers and I love hearing from people. And I love to be able to be sharing in a monthly newsletter things that are not exactly this. So it feels like a more personal group of space to be sharing things than on social. It's just kind of different. But I really like also that those are people that like they feel like reader friends. And I love interacting with people there. If I'm replying to someone in an email, it's not like on social where everybody else will see the reply, but it is just as meaningful, if not more, to have that sort of connection to folks as well, I feel like.
I love that. Yeah, I mean, my newsletter is the heart of what I do because I've been doing it so long. But even this morning, I woke up and I didn't really have anything. I had an idea, but I wrote the whole thing and I sent it out. And it feels like such an honest conversation. And I love that idea that that's another effort for you and that it's an effort that's worthwhile because you're actually, it's like what you said with conferences and chapters, like you're meeting people one at a time and that really has a powerful effect.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here, for sharing everything. I'll put all your links in the show notes. Thank you. This was awesome.
Yeah, no, thank you so much, Dan. It was great talking to you today.
You can find Gigi Pondian at ggipondian.com. That is GIGIPANDIAN. Over on Instagram and Twitter, the same name, Gigi at Gigi Pondian. And of course, you can find her books wherever books are sold. My name again is Dan Blank. You can find me at wegrowmedia.com or on social media at Dan Blank. Again, if you enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving a rating over on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you so much for listening until the end.